It is when we try to make our will conform with God's will that we use it rightly. To all of us, this is the most wonderful revelation. Our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring them into agreement with God's intention for us. This is in the third step, page 40 of the 12 and 12. They're talking about the answer. 3 opens the door. You're already sober. The purpose of the steps is not to get you sober. You wouldn't know what the hell these steps meant if you had a couple of drinks in you right now. But you don't, and you're sober a little bit of time, and you know exactly what they mean. Once we have come into agreement with these ideas, it's really new ideas, the new idea of step 1 and step 2 and the ability to make the decision to use your own will, those are the new ideas, it is really easy to begin the practice of step 3. This must have been about the 18th time I used the word practice. And all the times of emotional disturbance or indecision, we can pause. 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 10th step is the step of pause. Ask for quiet, and in the stillness simply say, the most magnificent prayer in the world, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Step 1. Courage to change the things that I can. Step 2. And the wisdom to know the difference. Step 3, for it's only by making the decision will you get the wisdom to not do it by yourself. It says in the dictionary that wisdom is to know when my will is not in line with the will of the creative intelligence, the spiritual universe, to ask a question. A decision is to bring my will into agreement with God's will, into agreement with my new idea, to turn worrying and judgment over, and to use the serenity prayer. I mean, if I did nothing else but these 3 steps, I could spend the rest of my life doing them. But I would be out of balance because there's 9 more. So let's have a quick cup of coffee and we'll go on to step 4. Okay, we're back, step 4. So now I'm going to go through step 4 and I'm going to try to, as best I can, tell you what we have done, how we approach this personal inventory. I would suggest that if you have not, if you're listening to the tape or whatever, and you have not, done the normal AA drill with your sponsor and done an inventory as it's described in the big book and clearly, then please, don't do this for a few years. But if you choose, this is a personal inventory. There will be nobody on the inventory but yourself. Kind of interesting. So step 4, made a searching and feel, and what I'm going to try to do after I finish the step in the 12 and 12 is describe to you exactly the columns and how we've taken this inventory. It's really more of a fun thing. And, of course, it's just a suggestion. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Huge step. Starts out, as every step seems to, with a profound couple of words. Creation gave us instincts for a purpose. You know, it's interesting now, because he didn't say God gave us instincts for a purpose. He said creation. Anything you want it to be. Anything you believe in. Instincts in the dictionary, and there's a thousand different, is a natural or acquired tendency. A few lines down it says, so these desires, these instincts, for sexual relationship, for material or emotional security. So sex, instinct, social instinct, and security instinct seem to be the 3. Are perfectly right and necessary and are surely God-given. Yet these instincts, so necessary for our existence, often far exceed their proper functions. Powerfully, blindly, and many times subtly, they drive us, dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, material and emotional security, sex, social, or security instincts. I'm trying to use the same 3 words. And for all importance, for an important place in society, often tyrannizes. Are you okay there, Dorothy? Is it okay? Okay. When thus out of joint, man's natural desires cause him great trouble, practically all the trouble there is. Now, great trouble is powerlessness. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. So powerlessness is misdirected instinct. And instincts get misdirected because of fear. When that happens, our great natural assets, the instincts, have turned into physical and mental liabilities. Step four is our vigorous and painstaking effort to discover what these liabilities in each of us have been and are. We want to find out exactly how, when, and where our natural desires warped us. We wish to look squarely at the unhappiness this has caused others and by ourselves. By discovering what our emotional deformities are, we can then move toward their correction. Without a willing and persistent effort to do this, there can be little sobriety or contentment for us. Without a searching and fearless moral inventory, most of us have found that the faith which really works in the daily living is still out of reach. And then it goes on to talk about some of the more common emotional deformities. Placing sex desire ahead of everything else, obsession for financial security, dependent and completely upon a stronger person for guidance and protection, disillusionment and helplessness, fear, people who go power mad, they give you 1,000 descriptions in the book here. And then whenever a human being becomes a battleground for instincts, there can be no peace. I really could feel that when I read it a while ago. When you become a battleground for instincts. Because isn't that what it feels like when your instincts are misdirected and you can't seem to control them? And I think during those battlegrounds, while you can be sober as a judge, but you will not have peace. And I think untreated, misdirected instincts cause a spiritual deficiency. Spiritual deficiency allows you to have no defense against a drink. Every time a person imposes his instincts unreasonably upon others, unhappiness follows. They talk about demands made on other people for too much attention or protection, and love can only invite domination, revulsion. And then they can go ahead to summarize what they've described in the 12 and 12 as being a collision of instincts. Also in the 12 and 12, on the prior page, they called it misdirected instincts. Now it's a collision of instincts. In these ways, we are set in conflict not only with ourselves, but with other people who have instincts too. So it's no surprise to me that later on, we're going to need steps 8 and 9, and 10 and 11, obviously, for these other people who have these misdirected instincts, and we have our misdirected instincts, and boom, this is big collision. Alcoholics especially should be able to see that instinct run wild in themselves is the underlying cause of their destructive drinking. So as we discussed a few moments ago, that if you do not handle these misdirected instincts, and they create a spiritual deficiency that then tells you that you no longer need Alcoholics Anonymous or need to attend meetings or need to stay close, then you will go back to that solution. The opposite of that solution of drinking is to make a decision to go to God. So let it not be misunderstood that it is necessary and very important for us to find out what that underlying cause of these things are. Because peace of mind is the greatest, and enlarging your spiritual condition is the protection against ever having to go back to the disease of alcoholism. And then now he goes on to call it deeper and deeper and deeper, because you can see usually in the reading of the steps, start out here, get a little more redundant, and eventually you'll start to feel it right in here. So now he says, this perverse soul sickness is not pleasant to look upon. So we've gone from misdirected instincts to a collision of instincts to perverse soul sickness, all the same thing. Instincts on a rampage, Balkan investigation, is it not true? The minute we make a serious attempt to probe them, we are liable to suffer severe reactions. Now, you know, some of the severe reactions, when you begin to look at yourself in this deep spiritual manner, in this layer below all of it, you know, the physical, emotional, spiritual, the triangle, the shamrock, all of it, the three parts. I mean, when you get to this part and you're hitting here, well, you know, you can plan on things happening. Depression, dark, anger, rage, whatever. I mean, self-directed anger, fears, because fears will go to battle to defend themselves. They will go to battle. The fear inside of you will go to battle to defend its right to stay in you. And you are going to be reasonably defenseless at the beginning because you are familiar with going to battle with your fear. That's your partner. Your partner is fear. The two of you team up and you've gone out there and you've done life. And now what this is saying, well, you must look at this partner and replace that partner. Well, do you think that partner is going to go willingly? Absolutely not. Do you think you're going to feel trust enough to let that partner go? Well, no, you're probably not. Because you've had more familiarity with that partner called fear than you have with God. You can also touch and feel and taste that fear. So you're liable to suffer severe reactions. And then they go on to tell you, you know, what some of those reactions could possibly be so that you can anticipate having them. The self-directed anger, which is depression. So there's a depressive possibility. There is a pride in reverse, grandiosity. This being so, we think it logically follows that sobriety, first, last, and all the time, is the only thing we need to work for. We believe that our one-time good character will be revived the moment we quit alcohol. If we are pretty nice people all along, except for our drinking, what need is there for moral inventory now that we are sober? The most common defense against having to look at yourself. Giant misconception. We also clutch at another wrong, wonderful excuse for avoiding an inventory. Our present anxieties and troubles we cry are caused by the behavior of other people. So then we start blaming right away. Therefore, we think our indignation is justified and reasonable, that our resentments are the right kind. Now, I don't know what the right kind of resentment you have, but every time I have the right kind of resentment, I am in judgment. This is, then the sponsor promptly proves by talking freely and easily and without exhibitionism about his own defects, past and present. Present is as a sober human being. This calm yet realistic stock taking is immensely reassuring. The sponsor points out that the newcomer has some assets which can be noted along with his liabilities. This tends to clear away the morbidity and encourage balance. Certain words should be popping out to you all over the place here that you should be thinking about in this month as you work each step. Balance. As soon as he begins to be more objective, the newcomer can fearlessly, rather than fearfully, look at his own defects. You know, when they say encourage balance, you know, I can't see the word balance now without thinking of sanity. I can't think of the word balance without thinking of unmanageability. The decision is not made to treat unmanageability and go to God with it, it will become insanity. If it's insanity, it's out of balance. This is because people who are driven by pride of self-consciously blind themselves to their liabilities. These newcomers scarcely need comforting. The problem is to help them discover a chink in the walls their ego has built through which the light of reason can shine. Every time I read this newcomer, these newcomers, I know that when I found that I was always on the path, but I was not searching. I was on the path the minute I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. You are placed on the path. You say, I can't find God, I'm not on the path. Yeah, you're on the path. The minute you got sober, got plunked into AA, you're on the path. You may not be looking around and thus not searching, but you're on the path. It's impossible not to be on the path. Whether you like it or not, and you think it's a spiritual program or you don't, you're on the path. Searching, now that's a whole other story. And then they talk about the other things that you have to deal with. Self-justification and everything. So it never occurred to us that we needed to change ourselves to meet conditions, whatever they were. Now, is that not one of the greatest definitions of humility? That it would occur to you that you needed to change yourself to meet conditions, whatever they were. The part that sentence could be ended with is without judgment and with acceptance. It never occurred to us that we needed to change ourselves to meet conditions, whatever they were, without judgment and with complete acceptance. Not much is required, is it? But in AA, we slowly learned that something had to be done about our resentment, self-pity, unwarranted pride. We learned that if we were seriously disturbed, which is worried, our first need was to quiet that disturbance. How do you quiet a disturbance? How do you quiet a disturbance? You accept it and you do not judge it. Now, you may accept it, but if you're judging it, it is not quiet. Regardless of who or what we thought caused it. As you know, in step 3 it said very simply, and in step 2 also, we must stop fighting everything and everybody. Tremendous promise here. We learned that if we're seriously disturbing, when I'm disturbed, I'm worried. Our first need was to quiet that disturbance, regardless of who or what we thought caused it. I do that with the Serenity Prayer and the use of the 10th step by pausing now. To see, first of all, we had to admit that we had many defects, step 6. Even though such disclosures were painful and humiliating. Where other people were concerned, we had to drop the word blame from our speech and thought. No judgment whatsoever. For we had started to get a perspective on ourselves, which is another way of saying that we were gaining in humility. And what is a perspective on yourself? How do you get a perspective on yourself? Accept yourself. If you begin to accept yourself, you get a perspective on yourself you've never seen before. His individual character defects, let's see, human beings are never quite alike, so each of us, when making an inventory, will need to determine what his individual character defects are. Having found the shoes that fit, he ought to step into them and walk with new confidence that he is at last on the right track. Excellent. Again, we're talking about acceptance. It doesn't say, oh my God, I just found this out about myself, I'm going to obsess and kill myself over this defect of character. I'm going to dwell upon this and I'm going to talk about it in every meeting I can possibly find. And every other human being I can possibly find, because I can't believe that I have this. I cannot believe that I am like this. Oh my God. It says quite simply here. Having found the shoes that fit, the uncomfortable shoe be it, he ought to step into them and walk with new confidence that he's unraveling. I mean, isn't that fantastic? Just jump right into this character defect and say, okay, I accept you. Make it fit. Accept it. This is what we're working on. Shine a light on that character defect. Keep the light on it. It's going to go away. The good and the bad. You see, I think in the spiritual universe there is no good or bad, right or wrong, reward or punishment for that matter. There's nothing like that. There's just experience. There's just experience. The experience of here it is, I accept it, move on. New experience, must accept it, move on. New experience. Gotta accept it, move on. Incredible. What comes with each move on? Thank you for the miracle of being able to see this and move on. Thank you for the miracle. Thank you for the miracle. Oh, I'm having a miracle. Oh, we're in a miracle. It is a miracle. All because I didn't have something I liked. And I began to learn how to accept it. It was such a shock for me. I used to think that, you know, you accept that, I don't know, years ago when I was in the 70s when I first got, sober just a couple of years, and, you know, the Gestalt therapy thing was really, really big. You know, we're all going to therapy and we're all banging each other with batons and, you know, whatever. You got to accept all this stuff and accepting. I mean, because one of the great things about being sober is you get to do it all. You know, the latest thing, the latest guru, the latest whatever. We're all out there doing it. I mean, you know, they should take some survey. If how many people are on AA, hell, we'd all be out there doing some finding, always looking. The people that have the answer are out there looking the most, right? So I'm out there, and they would say to us, well, you have to accept this thing about yourself. And I say, fine, I accept it. I accept this. I accept this. And I, you know, beat a thing, a pillow with a baton and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I never made it my own. I never made it my own. I accepted it, but I judged it. I didn't like it. I didn't like it. So now, is that really loving acceptance? No. That's I accept it, and I can't believe that I have this problem. So whatever it was that I accepted just got washed out by not the grace of God and the light of God and be removed, but by another problem that I've now compounded it with that I now don't accept. So back we went to therapy, thousands of dollars later, when all I had to do was step into it with new confidence. But But all who are least reasonable will agree upon one point, that there is plenty wrong with us alcoholics, about which plenty will have to be done if we are to accept sobriety, number one, progress, number two, and any real ability to cope with life, number three. Parlous over, alcohol, sobriety. Restored to sanity, coming to believe, progress. Any real ability to cope, the decision to get help. One, two, three. Steps are everywhere. From once you start seeing them in everything you read, and every way you read, and everything you talk, and everything that everybody says to you, and everything you listen to, my God, they become ingrained in you so that you almost don't know how to function without the steps. You wear them like a loose garment. They become part of you. To avoid falling into confusion over the names these defects should be called, let's take a universally recognized list of major human failings, the seven deadly sins, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. It is not better, and then they go on to describe all sorts of things here. For pride leading to self-justification are always spurred by conscious or unconscious fears. Very important. Are they real or are they imagined? Very few real fears in life. It is the breeder, the basic breeder of most human difficulties, the chief block to true process. True process. Process. Code word to the fourth dimension. We're going somewhere. Pride lures us into making demands upon ourselves or others which cannot be met without perverting or misusing our God-given instincts. Out of balance. When the satisfaction for our instincts of sex, security, and society become the sole objects of our life, then pride steps in to justify our excesses. All of these failings generate fear. A soul sickness, just said it on page 44, in its own right. Then fear in turn generates more character defects, real or imagined. Unreasonable fear, imagined, that our instincts will not be satisfied drives us to covet the possession of others, to lust for sex and pride, to become angry, envious, eat, drink, grab for more, fearing we shall never have enough. We become a sloth, grudgingly, da-da. These fears are the termites that ceaselessly devour the foundations of whatever sort of life we build. Now, I don't know about termites. We got them. Santa Monica by the sea there. Great building. Thousands of little termites. I mean, they are like endless, these things. Little termite stuff everywhere. So when I saw this thing, and I now have termites, I thought, Jesus, it took on a new meaning. I mean, if I could put much vigilance and diligence into building my spiritual foundation, as those termites have, and taking down our building. As we persist, a brand new kind of confidence is born, and the sense of relief at finally facing ourselves is indescribable. These are the first fruits of step four, the acceptance of yourself. His character defects, representing his instincts gone astray now, have been the primary cause of his drinking and his failure at life. Very subtle, this guy, Wilson. One should remember you're on AA, but, you know, the drinking thing. But your failure at life. Is your instincts gone away in collision? Da-da-da-da-da-da. He's done everything to these instincts now that's possible to let you know that they're out of control. That unless he is now willing to work hard at the elimination of the worst of these defects, both sobriety and peace of mind will elude him. You know, I'm not certain there's a difference anymore for me between sobriety and peace of mind. I think there's a difference between being dry and being sober. That's a whole other conversation. Now, willing to commence the search for his own defects, he will ask, clearly the word here, ask, just how do I go about this? A question. Can you imagine? They have a question here. How do I take this inventory? And, of course, as you know, the best way to start an inventory, if you're stuck on taking one, is to ask 1,000 questions. Questions you would ask will get you going. So step four is the beginning of a lifetime practice. Now, it doesn't say do this once, you'll never have to do it again. It says the beginning of a lifetime practice. Unless there's something pressing in my life, every April I take a very thorough, fearless and searching inventory based on the thoughts that are in my mind the day I take it. I do not start at the beginning as I did for my original AA inventory. I start from today. I'm usually worried about tomorrow. I only have two things that frighten me now. that I'll lose what I have and not get what I want. Everything else falls by the wayside. He might make a rough survey of his conduct with respect to his primary instincts for sex, security, and society. When, how, and in just what instances did my selfishness, and then they go on with it, hundreds of questions here. Why? Just how did I? How did I? Will I? When will I? Did I? Also, the importance for most alcoholics are the questions. The questions are very important. And I'm not going to go into all of that now, but in the next two pages are nothing more than tons of questions you can ask yourself. And then it says, and friends will need to cross-examine themselves. Well, now how do you cross-examine yourself? You ask yourself 100 questions. The most common, so then the questions of life become critically important as we get closer now to step 11. The most common symptoms of emotional insecurity, worry, anger, self-pity, depression, etc., they're all the result of fear, as we know, and they go on to talk about all the results of having that fear, worry, fall, past, present, future, your financial insecurity, or if my disturbance was seemingly caused by the behavior of others, why do I lack the ability to accept the conditions I cannot change? Serenity prayer. There are sort of fundamental, these are the sort of fundamental inquiries that can disclose the source of my discomfort, indicate whether I am able to alter my own conduct, or so adjust myself serenely to self-discipline. Very interesting statement now. Whether I may be able to alter my own conduct, or so adjust myself serenely to self-discipline. Now, you may be able to take contrary action and just stop it right away, but there's a very good chance that you're going to have to practice the habit of stopping. You know, how do I stop? How do I stop? I can't stop. No, you're just not practicing it. If it requires stopping every second, then that's what you have to do. If you're capable of not drinking a second at a time, a minute at a time, an hour at a time, 24 hours a day at a time, then you're capable of stopping a negative thought in that darkness, 1 second at a time. Same exact thing. We are practiced in how to have the habit of change. We are sober. We have practiced the habit of not drinking. I mean, what could be bigger? We're experienced in that already. Anyway, it goes on to talk about the questions and the questions and the questions and the questions and the questions. Therefore, thoroughness ought to be the watchword for taking an inventory. In this connection, it is wise to write out the questions and the answers. It is an aid to clear thinking and honest appraisal. It is the first tangible evidence of our complete willingness to move forward. Later, as a result of these questions and answers, and what we do in our group is in the fifth month, we ask each other questions. We know each other so intimately now that we just ask each other back and forth, well, what about this and what about that and how did you do with that? And I understand that you had that. And it's amazing what we can remember about each other from year to year and month to month. And, you know, last month this was happening to you. You never mentioned it. What happened? Yeah? Two things have happened when somebody never mentioned something that was a big deal a month before. A, the miracle happened, it's gone. Or B, they've self-justified it and it's buried and it's going to come back up. That's what good friends are for on AA. So later, these questions become open-ended questions and you ask God for the answer. Now on the fourth step, this is exactly what we do. You don't have to write any of this down and maybe in the tape, but I'll try to explain it to you. We know now that for ourselves, and we've been sober, I would say the consensus is a reasonable period of time. We've all done the sponsor thing and the inventory is the correct way. So now what we're doing is we're just doing it to in our current day life. So the first thing we do is we get a piece of paper and we make a big, we put a T-square on it. You know, you draw a line with it lined down the middle and it's got two sides. And we list our fears. Well, actually, erase. The first column, we just list our fears. Just list our fears. Spontaneously list our fears from this moment, today, now. Boom, what's on your mind? Unedited, free-flowing thought. Just list anything. Spiders, I don't know, anything. List the fears, spontaneously. One right after the other. Maybe you'll have 3, maybe you'll have 30. Doesn't really matter. It's irrelevant. Lots does not mean good inventory. It probably means nonsense. After we listed the fears spontaneously, we then go back and we sweep the file. This is what I do. I'll personalize it because it's my own experience. Sweep the file in my mind. Now, in my mind, there are 3 little files. Big, really. There's a file that says sexual instinct, social instinct, security instinct. And I go through that sexual instinct file and I think, is there anything bothering me? because fear is a bother. If I'm bothered by something, a slight sense of unmanageability, there is a fear brewing in there that is ready to go to battle with me. So I say, is there anything in there now that just bothers me, that I'm curious about? And I sweep that file. I say, oh, no, that's okay. And then I go into the, sexual one. Then I go into the financial, the security file, which is about money, property. And I sweep that file. I see if there's anything bothering me in there. And then I go to the social file. And I look in there and I see now if there's anybody threatening me or I do feel whatever, you know, what's going on in there. And I check that out. And I list any fear that comes out of those that process of just saying, what's in here, what's in here, what's in here. And I just write it down. And that's all there is in me today. I don't go back to when I was born, when he did it and she did it and they did it. Today, I survived my alcoholism, I survived my childhood, and I'm surviving Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm current. So whatever's left on me today, that's what I do. And then I add them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, whatever. And I put down the number. I add them up because I do it from year to year and it's just fun. The next column is that T column. Draw a line, separate it down the middle. On one side, I put worry at the top, and on the other side, I put judgment. Because you see, all of my fears, my experience, produce only two things. I either end up worried or judging you or myself. If I worry, it's about the future, so I put the word future under worry, and if I judge myself, it's about the past, so I put past under judgment. So I have today's fears, and I have the result, untreated, of those fears, worry or judgment. I then take the list of fears, and I check. I look at each one at a time, check worry or judgment. I try to pick one. Since nobody's testing me here, it doesn't really matter whether I, you know, pick the right one or not. It's about me, it doesn't matter. And I try to pick one, only because it's easier to not have confusion. If I absolutely can't pick one, I mark both. First year, I mark both on everything because it's my nature. Second year, you know, I really try to analyze it. The third year, I thought, this is ridiculous. I just flashed through it. And then I added them up. And I realized, for me, over the first few years, I spent, let's say I had 100 fears, making this up. And I added up the two columns of the worry and the judgment. Well, you know, for the first few years, I was really a big judger. But I got really kind of good at the steps and realized how really sick and the soul perversion of this judgment was for me. So I kind of worked on that. So it was like maybe 70 little things under judgment and 30 under worry. And then the next few years, God, I started to worry a lot. I'd be sitting around in the third month, you know, the month where you listen to yourself think. And I'd be thinking to myself, but like pretending I worked for the AA Times or something. And I would think, now I'm going to report everything that Lila thinks in the third month, in the month of March. And the stuff that I would think, I would worry myself to death. I think, geez, you do nothing but worry. You don't even have to worry. You worry about things you don't even have to worry about. You create things to worry about. It was really a productive means of constructive thinking. So now it doesn't really matter. I mean, because the ultimate in 10, 15 years from now, you're going to find out there's no worry at all. It's all judgment. You wouldn't even be worried about it if somebody wasn't going to judge you. You weren't going to judge yourself. But it doesn't even matter in AA if you know the answer. It's more fun having the process and the search. The third column gets to be really fun. It's one of those columns with two parts. And on the one side we put imagined, and the other side I put real. Because there's only two kinds of fears. They just talked about in the fourth step here, and they're either real or they're imagined. They're conscious or they're unconscious. They're either real or they're imagined. And I go back to that list of fears and I check. Real. Now the first couple of years they were all real. Everything was real. Well, the next few years, it's a little mixed. Oh, very rarely do I have a real fear anymore. Most of them are imagined, the worst kind. They're like little termites in there. Imagine. And then I total them up. Now, any that appear on the real column, I then say, as a result of what I imagine, or what I believe, rather, to be a real fear, and it's a handful, maybe if they're... If you have 30 fears, you'll you know, probably have 10 that might be real. You know, real. That somebody could be dying is a real problem. You know, or any real thing. There's some real stuff that happens out there. And beside that real thing, I put down what the nature of me, untreated, does with it. Because if I have a fear, untreated, I will end up greedy, pride, envy, sloth, lust, anger, or gluttony. My reaction, without question, will be one of those seven deadly sins, and or two or three of them, all at the same time. Don't get out of bed for a week, sloth. Overeat 15 tons of ice cream things, gluttony. Not eat at all, gluttony. Don't sleep at all, sloth. Every coin has a side. Just because they mention these sides doesn't mean that in today's sophisticated world we don't have much more clarity now about what these things are. Greed, pride, envy, sloth, lust, anger, and gluttony. I mean, how many people, when you are upset about something, have you gone to for sex, comfort, or something? When really, did you care about them at all? Or are you just needing to satisfy yourself? I mean, really, it gets really a depth of honesty that's extraordinary when you start to look what that fear will motivate you to do. The next column is just a column, and in there we put down, beside each fear, or after each of the, just the real ones now. If they're imagined, they're absolutely irrelevant. You will bring them back and bring them back and bring them back. And if you bring them back enough, and they go untreated without any spiritual application or at all, then eventually you're going to make them real, so they'll get there. It's a matter of time. In the last column, we list then the instincts that are out of balance and what those character defects become. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and inconsiderate. That's what happens to me. If I'm greedy, I am obviously selfish. However, any of them can be selfish. You know, the best thing is that if the basic fear is that you're going to lose what you have and not get what you want from me, this is my experience. Well, and I think that you're going to threaten what I have, you can bet I'm going to be selfish. If I think that you're not going to, or you're going to prevent being in the way of my getting what I want, well, there'll be nobody that will be more dishonest and self-seeking than me. If you say to me, gee, I think you're a little out of hand here, and maybe you really are just afraid you're going to lose what you have and not get what you want, well, I'm going to be dishonest and say, how could you say such a thing of such a spiritually endowed person as myself? And if you insist upon saying, well, gee, maybe, you know, you need to look at that, well, I will become inconsiderate and tell you to go straight to hell. It's none of your business. That's real life. Now, maybe I won't be right up front about it. Maybe I'll just be passively aggressive. Snub you, or some stupid thing like that. You know, the sandbox of life, which I've learned how to play in AA, means we throw sand on a lot of people, and a lot of people threw sand on me, and we all say it's over. But I've had all these instincts go completely out of whack in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had all those fears, most of which were imagined, most of which produced extreme worry and judgment in me, caused ulcers, all sorts of things, go completely out of whack, put me in a state of greed, sloth, envy, lust, jealousy, all those things. And then I end up having this overwhelming sense of selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, or inconsiderate nature, and then I wonder what the hell's wrong with me. That's all we do. Because there's no other names on this inventory but mine. None. The first inventory I ever took that preceded this one, I wrote everybody's name down. Everybody had something to do with something. If I could eliminate all those people. And then somebody, I think it might have, it doesn't matter, who said, somebody said, well, gee, you got all these names here. I said, well, yeah, of course I do. I'm trying to figure out how to handle those people. And I said, said, well, why don't you change all those names to I. I must have had 50 names, I. I thought it was a stupid exercise. But by the 10th I kind of got it. That even if they were at fault, didn't really matter. Because I took it on, and I owned it, and it was all about me. So now, if somebody's doing something to me, I no longer wonder what it is that they're doing to me. I'm more concerned with what fear I will have in me that will defend me, because I'm used to defending myself. I've defended myself my whole life. I thought alcohol was the best defender and ally I could ever have in that defense. Just because I got sober didn't mean I stopped defending myself. I now protect myself. Very different feeling. Very different feeling. Protecting myself means I can step aside. Stop fighting everything and everybody. If I have a moment of pause and I can do that. Say, gee, I'm powerless over the situation. I need some power. I better make a decision to get that power. What's in the way? Better talk to somebody about this. I'm about to go off and kill the person. Well, I better accept that I have not handled this very properly thing. I just shot them. Oh, I better accept that about myself. It was a bad day. Oh, boy. Listen, God, I just shot somebody. Really sorry. The sky didn't open up. No thunderbolt came. Just this overwhelming feeling like, oh, wow. Okay, Lila, that wasn't very nice. But what are you going to do about it? Well, I'll see if I can wake him back up. Help me. Please help me, because I can't do this by myself. Gee, did I really shoot you? Thank God the bullet missed. I'm really sorry. Try not to do that one again. My fault. I was having a bad day. You got in the way. You cut me off. I didn't do the first step and realize I was powerless as soon as you did that. I didn't ask for power to get some help. I didn't make the decision to go to God. I didn't look at the fact that when somebody cuts me off, it threatens me, makes me feel insecure, because I'm not feeling really full of myself today. I feel actually a little less than. I didn't talk to anybody about how less than I felt, and then you cut me off, made me feel worse, and hey, that's what happens when you got untreated madness and instincts at a collision. So I had to shoot you. I'm going to try not to do that again. And the guy said, how could you feel like that about yourself? Hey, because God loved me anyway. Even though I tried to shoot you. And you know what? The fact that God loved me so much, I can't believe I didn't get thrown away for trying to shoot you. I can't believe that I'm not going to go to hell for trying to shoot you. I can't believe that nothing bad's going to happen to me. I'm probably never going to shoot you again. Unless you cut me off. No. So I'm very, very sorry. I'm very, very sorry. And the next day the guy comes and cuts you off again just to see if you're going to shoot him. Only this time, say, hey, wait, I'm going to pause now. I've made this mistake before. If I do it again, it's a new mistake. I'd rather not make it. I'm going to pause. I'm powerless over this son of a bitch cutting me off. I'm going to get some power. I'm going to make a decision to not react to that, to go to God and not to insanity. The fear inside of me says, get him. But the voice of the person that I talked to the last time I did that said, you don't have to, you can stop fighting everything and everybody. It's okay. And then I can say, oh, it's okay. I accept that I want to get them. Will you help me, step 7? Please help me. I want to get them. Please help me. By myself, I'll go get them. With you, I won't. Wave to him as he goes by. Hey. This is the amend, buddy. I almost got you again. Thank God. I'm back in balance in my mind. Whew, I'm current again until the next time somebody cuts me off. Dear God, what do I do the next time he cuts me off? What if he cuts me off again? When he cuts me off, how am I going to handle it? And 1,000 questions go through my mind so that I don't have to fantasize what I'm going to do to him. I just ask the questions. I don't think about what I'm going to do to him. And I have some peace. And I didn't cut him off. And he's going on his way, and I'm driving on my way, and you know, I forget about the guy. And I run into Jane, and she says, well, what happened on the way down the phone? I said, hey, I don't know. I had a great trip over here. It was beautiful. No traffic, nothing. She says, nobody tried to cut you off. Oh, yeah, some guy tried to cut me off, but I completely forgot about it. And then I can say, thank you. Now, that's a long-winded, real-life situation of high maniac drinking, doing all the things that you were doing, spitting in the face of God, did not throw you away then. Do you think that you are going to be thrown away because as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a little pilgrim on the walk of life, you're not nice? No. It's impossible to be thrown away. There's no waste in God's universe. There's no right, there's no wrong, there's no good, there's no bad, there's no waste. There's no judgment, and there's no worry. There's just unending, ever to be received, positive, flowing light. I need that stuff. I needed a lot of alcohol. I need a lot of God. On step five, we meet in the month of May. It says, submitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. The nature of our wrongs. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and inconsiderate. It says, of all A's 12 steps, all of A's 12 steps asked us to go contrary to our natural desires. Our natural desire, self-preservation, is on page 64. When it comes to ego deflation, the few steps are harder to take than five, but scarcely any step is more necessary to long-time sobriety and peace of mind than this one. AA experiences thought that we cannot live alone with our pressing problems and the character defects which cause or aggravate them. If we have swept the searchlight of step four back and forth over our careers, now just remember that little files in your mind. Sweep those files. Same thing as searchlight. Sweep that searchlight back and forth over all those fears. And it has revealed a stark relief those experiences we'd rather not remember if we have come to know how wrong thinking, which is our will, and action, which is our life, have hurt us and others, then the need to quit living by ourselves with these tormenting ghosts of yesterday get more urgent than ever. Turn our will and our life. Wrong, our will is our thinking, and our life is our action. He just changes the words, the third step. Even AA old-timers, sober for years, often pay dearly for skipping this step. They will tell how they tried to carry the load alone, how much they suffered of irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression, and how unconsciously, seeking relief, they would sometimes accuse even their best friends of the very character defects they themselves were trying to conceal, judgment. They always discovered that relief never came by confessing the sins of other people, as everybody had to confess their own. You know, many, 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 many meetings, we always say, and I'm sure it's everywhere, you know, welcome the newcomer, welcome the newcomer. You know, in my mind, I say to myself, welcome to you, the old-timer. The pain of sitting in a meeting and not having talked, as a newcomer talks regularly, can be very, very, very hard. And yet we still keep coming. Most of us would declare that without a fearless admission of our defects to another human being, we could not stay sober. It seems plain that the grace of God will not enter to expel our destructive obsessions until we're willing to try this. It doesn't say you have to do it forever, it just says try it once. As you well know, the minute you try that once, you know, you'll do it again and again and again. What we are likely to receive from step five, for one thing, we shall be rid of this terrible sense of isolation we've always had. Almost without exception, alcoholics are tortured by loneliness. We don't quite belong. There was always that mysterious barrier we could neither surmount or understand. We were finally struck down and left in terrified loneliness. The sense of belonging was tremendously exciting, and the isolation problem can be solved as a result of communicating with another alcoholic or anyone on the search. But we soon discovered that while we weren't alone anymore in the social sense, we still suffered many of the old pangs of anxious apartness. This is sober. Until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer.
sitting there all alone, wondering what the hell's wrong with you, just call somebody. Start talking. Call a friend on AA. You don't have to call anybody who'll tell you what to do. You don't need to be told what to do. You just need to ask questions. You just need to talk. You'll know what to do. The vital step was also the means by which we began. This vital step was also the means by which we began to get the feeling that we could be forgiven, no matter what we had thought or done. Here they're saying clearly, get rid of this concept of judgment. It is an impediment to your spiritual process. The greatest shadow I cast on my own light was a shadow of judgment of myself. When I stopped judging myself and realized God loved me anyway, I was humbled by that. And I have been unable to judge as severely my fellow man since that day, or myself. That doesn't mean I don't do it now. It just means not as much. But it was only when we resolutely tackled step five that we inwardly knew we'd be able to receive forgiveness and give it to. I was so happy to see this. You know, forgiveness and forgive the guy and forgive. Receive, it says. Receive forgiveness. Who needs the most reassuring forgiveness of all? Who needs to reassure me and forgive me more than anyone else I have ever met in my life? Me. Another great dividend we may expect from confiding our defects to another human being is humility, a word often misunderstood. Of course, now they're laying the groundwork for 6 and 7. To those who have made progress in AA, it amounts to a clear recognition, which is acceptance, step 6, of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. Humility in 7. Therefore, our first practical move toward humility must consist of recognizing our deficiencies, step 4. No defect can be corrected unless we clearly see what it is, step 6. Clearly see it. After you've talked to 5, your sponsor, you're clearly seeing it. You're bringing something specific to God, not bringing 1,600 years of torturous inventory. You're bringing a problem you have today. The objective at look at ourselves was achieved in step 4 was, after all, only a look. All of us saw, for example, that we lacked honesty and tolerance, and that we were beset at times by tasks. And then it goes on to talk about the things that, again, come up when you're starting to uncover, discover, and discard these things. Though now recognized, our defects are still there. Something had to be done about them, and we soon found that we could not wish or will them away by ourselves. More realism and therefore more honesty about ourselves are the great gains we make under the influence of step 5. More realism and more honesty. You get more realism and more honesty when you talk to another human being who you can honestly get feedback from. That's why it's important not to talk to somebody that's going to give you direction, but that's going to give you experience, that's going to share their experience. Big, huge, giant difference. It says that we couldn't praise ourselves fairly. Too much guilt, too much remorse, too much worry, too much judgment. Only by discussing ourselves, holding nothing back, only by being willing to take advice and accept direction, could we set, and now, what is this direction? How to use the steps to get to God. That is the only direction that we really should be giving each other. Could we set foot on the road to straight thinking, step 5, solid honesty, step 6, which is acceptance, and genuine humility, step 7. Though we may at first be startled to realize that God knows all about us, we're apt to get used to that quite quickly. When we are honest with another person, it confirms that we've been honest with ourselves and with God. I mean, this happens to me regularly. I mean, I figure God loves me and, you know, I get used to it. But my friend Gretchen reminds me regularly. My friend Jane reminds me regularly. My friend Sylvia reminds me regularly. You may think you're okay, but we've noticed. Going it alone in spiritual matters is dangerous. Lack, Lacking both practice and humility, they deluded themselves. That is what can happen if you do it by yourself. Direct guidance we may receive while we are still so inexperienced in establishing contact with a power greater than ourselves. So it's the beginning of the practice. You know, you just need somebody along the way. It's another little bridge to cross. It's another little threshold. I mean, that's what it's about. That's what the book is for. That's why he wrote it, you know, so that you know you're not alone. This person may turn out to be one sponsor, but not necessarily so. It may turn out, however, that you'll choose someone else for the more difficult and deep revelations. This individual may be entirely outside of AA. Everybody has the ability to transfer and be a channel. Absolutely everybody. I now, you know, when I go to bed at night and I ask my questions, what do I do about this? How do I handle this? Should I? Should I not? What do I do? I mean, I expect that the answer could come in the front of the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, I mean, the Wall Street Journal, watching some hokey television show from Charles, from anybody, from somebody that I run into from the waitress. Anybody. I no longer limit myself to just a person or a couple of people. But if I feel that I'm a little dark and I've cast a shadow on that light, then I go to the most spiritual person I know and I say, you know, something's wrong with me. Something is wrong with me. And we'll end up talking about God, or I'll call Chris Hicks, and I'll talk to her because she's been there a little further down the road than me and a little, you know, understands the spiritual thing, that nothing happens to us unless it's a spiritual problem. And we'll talk about how lucky we are and how good it feels, and we'll talk about this God thing and about this search and how fortunate we are to just be here. And while all around us is all these things are going on, and people are dying and living and in pain, and we'll think, oh, wow, you know. Not because we're not in pain that day, but because we know we have somewhere to go, we know we're on the path, we know we're going, and we know we'll never be alone again. And I have to be reminded of that. And we hang up the phone, I don't know what the hell the problem was that I had that called in the first place. No one ought to say the AA program requires no willpower. Here is one place where you require all you've got. Again, they're talking about your use of the will. God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. Newcomer, under the grace of God, this little umbrella, floating around, absolutely safe, safest place you've ever been in your whole life. Terrific. After a while, it'll start to rain life. If you have not waterproofed your little umbrella periodically, it's going to rain through. You are going to need the steps. You will need your will to put your little finger up, another little finger, cooperate, get the water repellent. Before long, your listener may tell a story or two about himself, which will place you even at more ease. Provided you hold nothing back, your sense of relief will mount from minute to minute. The dammed up emotions of years will break out of their confinement. This can happen regularly. Sober members of AA can have this experience of 20 and 25 years. I mean, I had so many dammed up emotions at 18 years, I almost blew the dam. And miraculously vanish as soon as they're exposed. One of the great benefits of any length of time on AA is that you do enough of this stuff, you do not have to worry about the things going away. You know they go away. You know because you forget them. You know you're driving home, you forgot. They vanish, and you expect them to vanish. You say, oh, yeah, yeah, they just vanished. And you say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're describing a major miracle. A person who could let go of nothing. Nothing until you were unconscious. No, they just vanish. And you go, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. It says, the damned up emotions of yours break out of their confinement and miraculously vanish as soon as they are exposed. You expose any problem to the light of the spiritual universe, to this creative intelligence, to this friend, to this God, to this power, and it will absolutely not be able to take it, just like Dracula in the movies. And when humility and serenity, which is acceptance, are so combined, something else of great moment is apt to occur. Many an AA, once an agnostic or an atheist, tells us that this is during the stage of step five that he actually felt the presence of God. I can't imagine that many of you have not felt that. I can't imagine, if you're anything like me, that you have forgotten what it feels like. It is so important to not forget and to begin to know that in the search, your search is to remember God. You've been there. You've had it all. You need to be restored to that place. Been there. You know the little story about the little person that had a baby. They had a little child, and then they went and had another little kid. I'll give you 2.5 seconds, and they had this little baby, and the little one that was already, I don't know, a couple of years old, wanted to privately and quietly and by themselves, alone, talk to their new baby brother. And the parents were so, oh my God, you know, we can't do that because, you know, the kid could go in there and strangle them. I don't know, you know, the usual paranoia. And finally they decided, well, we must. So they set up a baby monitor with the little new baby boy and a baby monitor outside the door so that if the little girl did anything to the little brother, you know, they would be ready. They clearly had forgotten God, but that's okay. So they had all this thing all set up, and they said to the little girl, all right, you can talk to your baby brother by yourself. And sure enough, she was delighted, and she closed the door, and they closed the door, my God, in there with the baby, and went up to the baby's crib and leaned down to the little boy's ear, brand new little baby, and said, help me, I'm beginning to forget God. Now, I don't know how old you are, I don't know how long you've been sober, it's irrelevant. But I can tell you something. I am just beginning to remember God. I'm 50 years of old age, I'm 28 and a half years sober, and I'm just beginning to remember God. And the slightest memory is changing my life. It's giving me strength to do things I never thought I could do. The strength to do nothing. And even those who had faith already often became conscious of God as they never were before. This feeling of being one with God and man, this emerging from isolation through the open and honest sharing of our terrible burden of guilt, which is worry, brings us to a resting place, where we may prepare ourselves for the following steps toward a full and meaningful sobriety. In the big book after step five, it suggests a point of review. They talk about now getting ready to deal with the less violent aspects of our defects in step six is what we will do. The practice of feeling one with God and experiencing more realism and honesty. So, It's a time to rest and enjoy the practice of accepting and noticing the numerous miracles you have and will receive in response to these questions that you ask. It's a time to prepare to do nothing, to enjoy the gift of retrospect, to stop and to rest. That one, that you've become honest and you will have this new integrity that's deeper and new meaning that you had before, and to appreciate all that's happened to you in the first five steps of this program before you go on. Before you go on. Before you go on. Time to rest. So that there's no more secrets. You're not going to bring any more secrets. Because when you get to step six, well, it's all different. It's a whole new journey. It's the why and the road, you know? It doesn't matter which side you take, but there's one side that gets you there a little faster. And it's the side where it says step six became entirely ready. But before you get there, it tells you to rest. Go back. Make sure that you've cleaned up the road, your side of the street. Make sure that you're not bringing in unnecessary baggage. It's going to tire you out. Step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Sorry, I forgot something. In our meeting on step five, in our step practice, out of step four came an old idea. Now let's use the most universal old idea, I am not enough. It's an old idea. It's an old idea. It's an old idea. And in step five, we talked about it, and we refined it. And some people have, you know, and an old idea is that one woman at one time had been attacked, and she was afraid, you know, and she was afraid she could not protect herself, and that was her idea. You know,
That was the old idea that she still carried with her. And most of them, but there's lots of old ideas. I mean, an old idea, you could all come up with one in about half a minute if you just look at your life today. And in the fifth month, we discussed that old idea, and we wrote it out. And everybody had their old idea. And now the sixth month, and in the fifth month, we thought, what is the opposite of that old idea? To be enough. To not be afraid and to feel that you're protected. Could be as simple as, I worry too much. Help me not to worry. A thousand things. I mean, I can think of a million old ideas. And in the sixth month, every single solitary day, we take that new idea. That new idea. And that is what we accept, the old idea, and we remind ourselves of our new idea. And in the sixth month, we accept our old idea as being the nature of who we are. We don't do anything about it. We don't try to change it. We just accept it as being the nature of who we are. And when that old idea produces those fears that cause us to act out, then we stop that immediately. We take contrary action. Because the second that negative thought comes along that starts to, and you don't catch it, and you don't realize you're powerless over it, and you've got to get the power and make the decision to stop it, the minute that thought comes along, it's no different than having a sip of a drink. One's too many and a thousand's not enough. That thought will occupy you. It has to be stopped immediately. You say, well, what do I do? How do I do it? I can't stop. I'm obsessed with these things. I'm obsessed. Yes. Stop. How? Stop. But I can't stop. Stop. There's no other way to take contrary action but to stop. Oh, you know, people who stalk people. How do I stop stalking them? My God, I find myself in the car driving over. No, you don't. You thought about getting in the car. You missed the moment when you thought about it. We all think before we take a drink. We all think. If you get sober, drink, you're going to drink that decision stone cold sober. You're going to make the decision months before you drink, by the way. Or days if you're new. You're going to be thinking about that in advance. You're going to build that up. You're going to never, if you take contrary action, why, it'll go away. It'll vanish miraculously. But if you don't, why, pretty soon you're going to be too far gone. That's the sixth step. We're entirely ready. What do you do? Stop thinking. If you have a negative thought, they talked about it earlier in the 12 and 12, negative thinking. Stop it. Now, I don't mean discuss it, analyze it, obsess about it, and review it with everybody you've ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous. You should be spending all of your time, if your experience is anything like mine, it will take all of your time to not do it. This is the step that separates the men from the boys, girls from the ladies. So it declares a well-loved trip, enough willingness and honesty to repeatedly try step six without any reservation whatsoever. The last time, the last step that they used without any reservation whatsoever was in the first step, when it related to your drinking. This is how important it is now that it relates to your thinking. God can and will, under certain conditions, remove defects of character. God, the often disputed question of whether God can and will, under certain conditions, remove defects of character will be answered in a prompt affirmative by almost any AA member. To him, this proposition will be no theory at all. It will be just about the largest fact of his life. Somebody says to me, I never got that. I said, did you drink today? Well, no, I've been sober, 17 years. I said, you got it. You just didn't recognize the miracle. You got it. The greatest defect that can be removed is the need to practice the disease of alcoholism. It's the greatest character defect I ever had. It was a sum total of every fear I ever had, saying, Lila, we have the answer for you. And I believed it.
And then one day, they said, "We are sick of you. You're not handling this answer very well at all. You're overdoing it. So why don't you just kill yourself?" "Well, I'm trying, for God's sake. Christ, I could live a long time." "Well, we're fed up trying to help you. So go ahead, use us, and you can be social, you'll have a socially acceptable form of suicide. You can drink yourself to death one day at a time. Nobody will stop you." So that is a huge defect of character, that I would choose that. It's gone, vanished, blink, miraculously gone, vanished. Why is it, and I didn't do anything about it, by the way, I just woke up one day, crawled up the bathroom sink, came out of an unconscious state asking God to help me, popped, the next thing you know, I'm in an AA meeting. How the hell did that happen? Series of events from that unconscious, practically conscious, unconscious, half a prayer, didn't even want to pray to it, wasn't praying to anything I believed in, didn't even care if God existed, preferred not. Come right out of this drunken state, asking for help. Must have had a moment where I wished it were true. Must have had a moment of honesty about my disease. Must have had a moment where I needed the hope, like the second step. Must have had a moment of faith where I said, "Ah, that's enough. Ah, it's the decision." And that set into motion events that changed my life, that ended up with me being an Alcoholics Anonymous in the strangest and most abstract way. Now, I don't think I can get help on a small little defect of character like selfishness or something, when my whole life can be changed in a prayer that was half conscious, half unconscious, didn't even want to have it. Powerful stuff. But when I became willing to clean house, which means to take contrary action on all of this information that you've already done in 4 or 5, you've already cleaned house in 4 or 5, you've discussed it, now you know what the hell's wrong with you today. When I became willing to clean house and then asked a higher power, God as I understood him, to give me release, my obsession to drink vanished. It's exactly the same today. When I'm willing to clean house and I ask my higher power to help me, whatever it is, as I understand that God to be, to give me release, my obsession will vanish. It was lifted right out of me, miraculously vanished. When I got in the habit of bringing these old ideas and accepting them about myself and giving them to God and saying, "What do I do about this again?" It became so clear to me over the years that every time I asked, I forgot the next day that I had this huge monumental problem the day before. And it was big the day before, big enough for me to have to stop and write this stuff out. Take a moment, big enough to pause. And I forgot. Now, I don't forget anymore, I just kind of expect it now. So I do it faster because it works. In AA meetings all over the world, statements just like this are heard daily. It is plain for everyone to see that each sober AA member has been granted a release from this very obstinate and potentially fatal obsession. So, in a very complete and literal way, all AAs become entirely ready. The minute you stopped drinking, you became entirely ready to make room for God. Entirely ready. To have God remove the mania for alcohol from their lives, and God has proceeded to do exactly that. Listen to this. Having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why then shouldn't we be able to achieve, by the same means, a perfect release from every other difficulty or defect? Couldn't be more clear. This is the riddle of our existence, the full answer to which may be only in the mind of God. Nevertheless, at least part of the answer to it is apparent to us. I believe if you practice the steps, it happens every time, each and every time, never not to happen. I have never not had it happen in the years that have passed. Never not had it happen. When men and women, by the way, that doesn't mean that I perfect release, means that I leave it perfectly released. That's why they have the 10th step, for when I go back and bring it back out of the box, brand new, as if it never was released before. When women pour so much alcohol into themselves, they destroy their lives. They commit to a most unnatural act, out of balance, instincts out of balance, all the usual things we just talked about. To find their instinctive desire for self-preservation, they seem bent upon self-destruction. By the way, just because you join Alcoholics Anonymous, this bent for self-destruction does not change all the changes you stopped drinking. They worked against their own deepest instinct, the instinct we talked about earlier of self-preservation. As they are humbled by the terrific beating administered by alcohol, the grace of God can enter them and expel their obsession. Here, the powerful instinct to live, by the way, the instinct to live fully and joyfully, the instinct to live is the absolute perfect cooperation between God's will and your will. The instinct to live can cooperate fully with their Creator's desire to give them new life. Means anytime you want new life, you can have more. Anytime you burn out the old life, anytime you use it up, anytime you throw it away, anytime you forget it, anytime you lose it, you can have more. Anytime. For nature and God abhor suicide. But most of all, suicide. Don't forget the suicide. To allow yourself to dwell in your negative mind day after day is suicide of the soul. Every normal person wants, for example, to eat, which is security, to reproduce, which is the sex part, to be somebody in society, which is your social instinct of his fellows. He did give man instincts to help him stay alive. It is nowhere evident at this time, at least in this life, that our Creator expects us to fully eliminate our instinctual desires. They talk about this balance. It's a very big thing in 4 and 5. As you know, you have to have the sense of balance. If you think you're going to be perfect right now tonight, you're out of balance. Whacked, already on a deficiency level, and you think you're on the way to great big spiritual enlightenment, enlargement. Since most of us are born with an abundance of natural desires, it isn't strange that we often let these far exceed their intended purposes. We depart from the degree of perfection that God wishes for us here on earth. I saw that perfection. I thought, hey, I can do this. They want us to be perfect. No, they don't want us to be perfect. We would far exceed our intended purpose if we were perfect. The perfection God wants for us on earth is to be balanced. This is the measure of our character defects, or if you wish, of our sins. If we ask, there's that word again we're not supposed to use. If we ask God, we will certainly forgive our derelictions, but in no case does he render us white as snow and keep us that way. And here it is. Here is step 6. When I saw this, it changed my spiritual life. It changed my AA life. It changed everything I'd ever believed. Without our cooperation. The first time that I heard and saw and felt, He will render us white as snow and keep us that way. In no case does he render us white as snow and keep us that way without our cooperation. It's a little umbrella, you know. It's a little grace umbrella. This is something we are supposed to be willing to work toward ourselves. God will not do for you what you cannot do for yourself. God will get you to the 6th step and give you the opportunity to cooperate in this major, massive spiritual universe, to actually play a role so that you can give and receive something. What a gift. You imagine. And God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself until you are ready for that day. I have a horrible, sneaking suspicion that because you're sitting here right now, you're probably ready for that day. This is something we're supposed to be willing towards. He only asks only that we try as best we know how to make progress in the building of character